From the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, this is Keeping Up with Public Health, Pandemic Response. This episode, we speak with Dr. Brenda Hoag and Dr. Bertram Jacobs about vaccine development. Dr. Hoag is a professor and virologist at the Arizona State University Biodesign Center for Immunotherapy. Her lab studies how coronaviruses assemble and their interplay with host cells that ultimately result in disease. Dr. Jacobs is interim director and a professor of virology at the Arizona State University School of Life Sciences. Dr. Jacobs is one of the world's foremost experts on vaccinia pox virus and has genetically engineered vaccinia as a vehicle against a number of infectious agents, bioterrorism threats, cancer, and other viruses, including HIV.
Dr. Hoag and Dr. Jacobs, thank you for joining us. Can you tell us how your research has joined forces to develop a SARS-CoV-2 vaccine?
So my lab works on coronaviruses, and we've worked on these viruses for a long time. And so we obviously have a lot of interest and expertise in understanding these coronaviruses in general. And the SARS virus, when it came along, we did a little bit of work on it. And we've done a lot of more basic studies directed at all of these human coronaviruses. When the new SARS-2 came along, Bert, a colleague, Sean Chin, and I, along with some other colleagues, both in CIBV and other centers in biodesign, we got together and discussed what is some of the technology, not just vaccines, but technology in general that we might be able to offer for providing some insight and potentially some therapeutics for our test for the new virus. And so that was how we came together.
That's great. You all have the capacity to come together and work on a project together. Can you explain how you are pulling in funding for the vaccine?
We're colleagues. We're here in the same center. And so it was easy for us to pull together. And we decided that the only mechanism that was available right there immediately for applying for funding for this was one of the grant mechanisms that NIH offers. And so the three of us pulled together quickly and we pushed a proposal out to NIH in a pretty short order, right, Bert?
Very short order.
Yeah. And so we have three different platforms now that we put into this proposal, and our three labs are working on these three different platforms. We will not hear from NIH. It'll be several months before this proposal is reviewed, unless it happens to be pulled up more quickly for review in light of the continuing pandemic.
Dr. Jacobs, your work with the vaccinia pox virus has been used in vaccines for a number of other viruses. What makes vaccinia a good vehicle for a coronavirus vaccine?
You know, my expertise is by no means in coronaviruses. I've been a pox virologist for the last 35 years. A vaccinia virus has been thought of as a vector for vaccine development for a long time. You clone any gene you want into a vaccinia virus. Vaccinia virus, we know a lot about. We know it's a good vaccine. Can we then use this vaccinia virus vector that we clone new things into to make immune responses to those new things? And about 15 years ago, we started working with a consortium funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to try to improve vaccinia virus as a vector with the idea of using it as an HIV vaccine. And so we spent probably 10 years improving the vector and spent another, 7 or 8 years testing it as an HIV vaccine, at this point in non-human primates. And we've been able to show that it gives improved immune responses. One of the issues with using vaccinia virus as a vector is that it causes complications in a fair percentage of people. What we've been able to do is attenuate the virus so that we believe it'll cause fewer complications, but still allow it to reproduce in human cells. And so we think the ability for the virus to reproduce in human cells will allow it to give a much better immune response. And certainly we've seen that in non-human primates. And so what we're basically doing is taking the vector we've developed over 15 years. We developed it initially for an HIV vaccine. Can we now convert it to be used as a vaccine for SARS-CoV-2?
The term novel coronavirus has entered the public lexicon. Does novelty mean virologists must start from square one when developing a vaccine?
Well, I think you can start from, not from square one, but from first principles. So we developed what we think is an improved vaccinovirus vector. We developed that to make an HIV vaccine, and we've shown that it's really highly immunogenic. And so we're using that platform, take out HIV genes, put in coronavirus genes. Can it give us, again, a very good immune response? Brenda and Sean are using virus-like particles made in different ways. And again, a lot of our more recent good vaccines are made from virus-like particles. You know, it's not completely from scratch. The details are new, but we can use a lot of what we've learned about vaccinology to try to bring that to bear on the new virus. In biodesign, we're trying three completely different platforms to see if we can either get one to work, or if not, does a combination work better? That's one thing we know about vaccines, is that combination vaccines generally work better than just going in with the same vaccine over and over and over again. If you start with a vaccine in one platform and then boost with a vaccine in another, a second platform, often you get a really good immune response. We don't know if you need that here or not, but that's something that I think the more vaccine platforms we throw at this, the better chance we'll get something in a short period of time.
It is worth mentioning that at the time of this recording, there are two vaccines in the first phase of clinical trials. Dr. Jacobs, can you comment on the platforms being used for these trials and what it means for your work?
One I know is an RNA-based vaccine. I don't know what this second one is. You know, they may work. They may not work. I think, again, you know, my take on this is if they work, great. If they don't work, we want to have a platform in place that can be tried to see if it will work. And so I think that's the way, you know, certainly that's the way I look at this. And I think a lot of other people are looking at it that way as well. Where people are, I think, is these are platforms that are reasonably easy to get up and running to get, you know, into trials. They may or may not be the best ones that are available. We'll only learn that, you know, as we go down the line. And I think, you know, one issue to think about is that, you know, these RNA and DNA platforms that are currently in testing, I don't believe we've ever had a vaccine approved that's just RNA or DNA. So the advantage of these is that they're almost certainly going to be pretty safe, because there are no virus infections or anything like that. I think the question is, will they give a good enough immune response? And I think that's still up in the air, because we've never had a vaccine based on these.
Dr. Jacobs, can you briefly explain what you mean by the term platform, and what are the most common platforms for vaccines?
Yeah, so what we've developed is a vaccinovirus that is highly attenuated but replication competent. And the reality is we can clone any genes we want into that. And so we call that a platform. We've used it as a platform to deliver HIV proteins into non-human primates. We can use it to deliver coronavirus proteins. We can basically use it to deliver any proteins we want. So that's our platform. Brenda has worked on how to make virus-like particles in coronaviruses for decades. And so that's the platform she's using. Sean Chen has worked on developing plants as a way to make proteins for vaccines. And he's done that for a number of different viruses. And so that's the platform he's using, taking advantage of all of the expertise they have on how to get plants to make proteins in the right conformation to give good immune responses. And so that's sort of the ideas on platforms. We all have our sort of favorite way of making vaccines. I don't know that any of us, we all believe ours is the best. I can tell you why I believe mine is the best. But the reality is, unless we try them head to head, we don't know what's going to be best. And again, I think using different platforms gives us the opportunity to do is combine platforms, because all of the data says that combined platforms give better immune responses than just immunizing with the same thing over and over and over again.
Dr. Hoag, can you tell us how the platforms using virus-like particles as vectors differ from the attenuated virus vectors, such as the ones developed in Dr. Jacob's lab?
My lab studies how viruses assemble, and that's how we came to be interested in virus-like particles a lot of years ago, and we've used that as one of our assays for looking at what is required for assembly of these coronaviruses. Yeah, and these virus-like particles, or VLPs that we call them, they really have the potential to serve as a good vaccine platform. One of the examples of a virus-like particle vaccine that we make use of now is for hepatitis B. And then also the papillomavirus vaccine is a VLP. And these VLPs, they basically, like Bert said, they're not replicating. They don't contain the genetic information. So they don't contain the genome of the virus that they are produced from. And they just consist of basically the outer shell of the virus displaying the proteins that are generally the ones that are important, or at least some of them are important for eliciting a good immune response. And they mimic the virus. So they are safe in that they don't have the genome, yet they mimic the virus, and so therefore they are presented to the host as the live replicating viruses, yet they don't replicate.
Dr. Jacobs, you mentioned before that combination vaccines often result in a better immune response. Referring back to the RNA-based vaccines currently in clinical trials, would it be possible for that platform to be used as part of a multi-platform vaccine, such as the ones being developed by your lab and Dr. Hoag's lab?
So I'll give you two answers to that. Answer one is, I hope so. Answer two is, industry hates multiple platform vaccines. Mm. They're difficult to do. They're difficult to get approved. They're expensive to get approved. They're expensive to put through trials. Industry hates it. If that's the only thing that works, my guess is we can do it. If single vaccines work, that's where it'll go, because that's much, much easier to do than these multiple platform vaccines.
Dr. Hoag, when thinking about the immune response to a vaccine for a coronavirus, which population should get the vaccine? Are there populations that should avoid it, maybe those with a history of chronic lung disease?
So I think that certainly based on the demographics of what we're seeing currently with the ongoing pandemic, initially it was really information that was coming out from China was that the mortality rate was much higher in the elderly, and there was a lot of focus on that. But I think that we're seeing from what is happening here in this country, and now that we know more about what the demographics of what was happening at the peak in China, that everyone is susceptible to this, and that certainly the disease burden seems to be higher for older individuals, and particularly for individuals that have underlying secondary diseases or conditions such as diabetes and heart disease and others. I think that some are listed, that those individuals are at very high risk. But we're also seeing younger individuals. I haven't seen any information to indicate if the number of deaths that we're seeing for younger individuals, if those individuals as well, there's a higher number of those with underlying conditions that may be contributing to the outcome. But I think that all individuals, particularly from younger people up through the elderly, will be candidates for a safe, effective vaccine. And of course, that's part of the testing that will be done ultimately as any vaccine moves through the different phases that it has to move through, showing effectiveness and safety. Different age groups will be looked at.
Concerning antibodies and immune response, is one platform or vehicle more reliable at getting a strong immune response?
Maybe I can start to answer that a little bit. Most virus-like particles, most immunogens that are proteins, give good antibody responses, tend not to give as good T-cell responses. And, you know, there's good evidence, I believe, that for coronaviruses, a good neutralizing antibody response probably can be protective. My guess is if we had our druthers, we'd rather have both an antibody response and a T-cell response, and usually to get best responses for both antibodies and T-cells, that often comes from a replicating or at least a viral vector of some sort or another.
So we know what the main target is that we need to elicit antibodies against for neutralizing these viruses. And that's known from work that's been done with animal coronaviruses. Certainly there was work that was done on SARS and also on the MERS virus, that the one that continues, has never circulated very far out of the Middle East, but that virus continues to circulate there. And so the protein that's called the spike protein that gives the, you've seen all of the images of the SARS coronavirus 2, and you have all these spikes that extend out from the particles. The proteins that form those spikes, that is the protein that interacts with the receptor on host cells to initiate infection. And we know that that is one of the main antibody responses when an individual is infected with any of these coronaviruses. And we know that if you get a good neutralizing response, that it can be protected. Now, there are some questions about the length of protection. So if you're immunized, for example, if we had a vaccine and you were immunized today, would you be protected for life or would you be protected only a few years down the way? And so that's the thing that we're going to have to, that will have to be determined once we have vaccines in place that can actually really be put to the test. And like Bert was saying, to get a good T cell or cellular immune response, we know that is important for these coronaviruses. And yes, if you have a replicating virus, that generally helps a lot in terms of eliciting a good T-cell response. And that's where these replicating, like these two POX platforms that we're looking at, that's where those may provide some advantage.
One last question before we go. Some media has reported that COVID-19 could become a seasonal issue similar to the flu. Do you see that happening with a coronavirus like SARS-CoV-2? And would that require adapting vaccines each year?
You know, many respiratory infectious diseases are here during the winter, and as the weather warms up and summer comes around, tend to go away. But when it's summer here, it's winter in the global south. And so we, you know, certainly that's what we see again with influenza virus. Their epidemics of influenza tend to be June, July, August. And ours tend to be November, December, January, February. And so you tend to have the virus going back and forth between the global north and the global south. And so, you know, is that a scenario that we might be seeing in the future? I think we have no idea, but I think that's one of the potential scenarios that could bring about the seasonality.
I think that most of us in the field expect we will see this virus again, and that it may have become embedded in what I refer to as the landscape of respiratory viruses, including influenza, that we deal with every year. But that remains to be seen. We have to see how we move through the next few months and what happens with all of the distancing and the other precautions that we're taking to try to curb this spread of the virus. And then also as we go into a new season, we move into summer, is that actually going to impact the spread of the virus as we see with influenza? This virus so far looks very stable. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some changes that we're seeing. And some of those changes we're seeing in two of the primary proteins, the ones that we've mentioned here already. We are seeing some changes there, but we don't know what those changes mean at this point. And so, but overall, the genomes of these viruses seem to be pretty stable at this point. So I think we're just going to have to wait and see.
Thank you, Dr. Hogue and Dr. Jacobs, for taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us today. The conversation has been insightful, and we're looking forward to seeing more from your work. Best of luck and stay healthy.
Thank you for the time. It's been an interesting discussion.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much. Everyone, stay safe.